Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome everybody to the Lifeboat Hour, October 19, 2014.
The poor.
This is the show where everybody knows that the game of industrial civilization is over, and that the game of me and mine and who cares about you is coming to an end. Everybody knows that in this time of loss and demise, we're struggling, all of us struggling, to cope with the deluge of feelings that come up and come over us as we try to process the enormity of losses around us. Overwhelmingly, the most popular shows on the Lifeboat Hour have been shows addressing grief. Two of the most popular shows we've had on the Lifeboat Hour were shows I've done with my friend and colleague, Francis Weller, whom I consider one of the foremost psychotherapists in the nation dealing with grief. If you want to go back and listen to those shows in the archives, they were done on February 23rd and April 27th of this year. Twice a year, Francis offers grief rituals, which involve a group of people coming together in Northern California for a weekend to move deeply into their grief and to support each other in a safe and nurturing environment. Francis learned this grief ritual from African shaman Maladoma Somme, and I've had the privilege of working with Maladoma, and tonight we have with us one of my very good friends from Northern California who's also worked with Maladoma, and who every November with his partner Maya offers a one-day grief ritual in the Bay Area on or near the date of the Mexican celebration of the Day of the Dead. Barry Spector lives in Berkeley. And his webpage you can find at www.barryandmayaspector.com. Now that's spelled Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, and A-N-D, Maya, M-A-Y-A, Spector, S-P-E-C-T-O-R.com. Barryandmayaspector.com. If you go to the webpage and click on the events option, you can read the details of the grief ritual, when it's going to happen, where, and how you can register. And by the way, this is a very reasonably priced event at $30 if paid in advance and $50 at the door. So without any further delay, I want to welcome Barry Spector to the Lifeboat Hour.
Hi, Carolyn. Good to talk to you again, especially about topic so dear to our hearts.
Yes, yes. And this is the perfect time of year, and you are the perfect person to talk to about this. So the first question I have for you, Barry, is, and it may sound like an obvious question, but it really isn't, why is grieving necessary in the context of our world of endless wars, catastrophic climate change, possible pandemics like Ebola, and daily increases in mental illness, violence, and suicide?
Yes, and it's interesting. You pose the question as if we have a choice.
Right.
I would say that we are grieving constantly, all of us, especially this year, especially this time of year, but especially as modern people, I mean, and especially as Americans. So, I would say that the grieving that we are doing is unconscious for the most part. There's a good metaphor I like to use. It's like we're driving with the emergency brake on.
Mm.
The grieving process is always, always beckoning to us just below the level of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any choice at all, I think it's in our choice to quiet the mind a little bit and turn off the electronics for a few minutes and just acknowledge that every single one of us in this culture, regardless of whether we've been carrying some recent personal grief, are all carrying a massive, massive weight on our shoulders of unexpressed, unresolved grief. And so If I were to answer your question directly as it was posed, I'd have to say it's important for us to pay attention and acknowledge that it's happening, and that there are constant reasons for us to be paying attention to what's happening all around us all the time. And if we don't, then we are blocked in our potential responses to the world as it is.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Were you going to say something else?
Yeah. There's an old African saying, when the heart weeps for what it has lost, the spirit laughs for what it has found. Mm. It seems to me that one of the main things we've learned from studying with these African teachers such as Maladoma and also other indigenous teachers from around the world is that our lives have been so utterly constricted because of our American denial of death and our unwillingness to face the imperative of grieving what we've lost, so much of what we've lost. And so Maladoma also said some quote direct something like to the effect of people who can't grieve can't laugh.
Right.
And I would add to that for those activists who are listening, people who can't grieve and aren't grieving on a regular basis can't really pull up the energy they need to be effective activists.
And as Francis has pointed out a couple of times on this show, you know, like when you have the fire of activism, and that's all you have is the fire, and you don't have the waters of grief, you will fry,
right.
You know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very important to talk about a few things that this culture tells us about grief. I'd really like you to elaborate on that.
Well, I would say we have a legacy, this Anglo-Saxon legacy, that doesn't allow the expansive emotions as part of masculinity. And part of that legacy, if we were to use kind of mythological terms and address what we do in the world as a culture, one of the things that the American Empire does is express violence at a distance. And to use the mythological image there, that's Apollonian violence. It's arrows shot from a long distance, in a sense. Currently, they're coming from drones and aircraft over the Middle East. But even the pilots who let go of those missiles, not to mention the guys sitting in bunkers in Nevada moving the joysticks that move the drones, not to mention all of us individual people around the nation, we are so far removed from the violence that this culture perpetrates that we can never have any real connection with it. It's part of our heritage as Americans to just deny the violence and rage that we all feel and to project it upon the others of the world. And so refusing to grieve is part of that. And anyone who's been to an American funeral knows what I'm talking about. They are the quietest, most reserved, most well-behaved events imaginable. But people from the third world come from very, very different traditions, and they are usually quite stunned to see how Americans behave at our funerals. I forget what was the question.
No, that's okay. I was just You know, you're answering the question, which is, you know, our attitude toward grief. Is there anything else you'd like to say about that? The ways that we've been programmed not to grieve, in other words.
I have an extensive section about this question in my book, Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. As I look at it, the great myths that determine how we act in the world change very, very, very slowly. But they are changing. And in the past 40 years or so, there have been many indications that the veneer of steely, unfeeling unemotionality in the American soul has been cracking. And it's to a great extent it's been due to the influx of influences from other parts of the world, especially the third world. I would say we have a lot to learn from, for example, from the culture of New Orleans and the jazz funerals and the tradition there. But also, and I'm sure we'll get into it further in this hour, the big influence coming in from Latin America and especially Mexico, having to do with Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos.
Right.
And I'm sure we'll get further into that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that for sure. And you know, just to remind our listeners, I mentioned earlier that Barry and his partner Maya, and I as well, have all conducted grief rituals in the past. And the format that we use, as I mentioned earlier, is what we learned from Maladoma Somme, who's an African shaman. He's from the Dagara tribe of West Africa. And that tribe and many indigenous cultures in the world have a very different attitude toward grieving than we have in the West. How would you describe, Barry, what the attitude of these indigenous cultures is, and how do the Dagara view the process of grieving? And related to that, would you say a bit about indigenous grief rituals across the world and how they're so dramatically different from the American denial of death?
I personally haven't been to West Africa, but folks like Francis and other friends of ours have. When someone dies in the traditional villages of West Africa, everything comes to a halt. Now, the village where Maladoma came from has several thousand people in it, and this is the third world. And you know, people die regularly in the third world in these villages. And when one of these events happens, and when a death occurs, everybody stops what they're doing, and for three full days, and I wish we had the luxury to do this kind of thing in our rituals, but in that culture, and for three full days, the entire community and everybody visiting the community feels the responsibility to get completely involved in the 24/7 event of the grief ritual. And the grief happens again in a great contrast with what we're used to, with constant drumming and chanting and dancing and movement. They definitely feel that that grieving is a physical process that involves the body, and it's absolutely a communal process. Again, this is a great distinction with us. Most of us, if we don't do it, haven't done it ourselves, we certainly know many people who have spent much of the time after a loved one has died in silent contemplation alone. And anything I've read about anything in the third world, in the indigenous tribal world, this is absolutely incomprehensible. To them, it's absolutely obvious and apparent that the grieving process is a communal process. And part of the reason why they say that is, and they acknowledge that when a person has unresolved grief in their souls, they infect the rest of the community. And so it's literally that person and the whole community's responsibility to deal with it. And now these are folks who have never read anything about family systems, psychological theories, you know. But they know it very well from hundreds, if not thousands, of years of their own traditions. They know that you have to get it out, or it will make you sick. And if it makes you sick, it'll make the whole village sick at some level. And another aspect that I've learned about in studying grief rituals around the world is an interesting phrase that the anthropologists describe as secondary burial. They don't do this in West Africa, but they do it in East Africa. They do it in Greece, in Spain, in large parts of Asia, especially Bali, but also in China, where the body is buried, and then after a number of years, the body is dug back up out of the ground. It's disinterred and it's inspected to see that the bones have been purified, and that indicates to the people that the soul has moved fully from this world through the sort of intermediate liminal world on to the other world, and they say it absolutely requires the participation of the living. This is the interesting part. And even Catholicism acknowledges that in some of its old rituals, that the living must work very hard in their own grieving process to help the souls of the deceased move fully from this world to the other world. And to the extent that they have not moved fully to the other world, they are dangerous to those of us in this world. They become ghosts. In Martin Prechtel's people among the Mayan people in Guatemala, they say that if a deceased soul had not been fully grieved by the living, it would come back to the village and it would feed upon the living, and their sense of it is that if the Dogaro in West Africa agree completely on this issue. If the living are able to fully grieve the dead and encourage them in their journey to complete their journey to the other world, then the dead become ancestors instead of ghosts. And then as ancestors, they are willing and able to be of help to those of us on this side of the veil. So there's incredible wisdom and long-term knowledge that these indigenous people have to offer us about this process.
Well, before we continue, I'd like us to hear a song which weaves so beautifully into our conversation. And Barry was talking about the Day of the Dead in Mexico. And, of course, his grief ritual on November 1st is going to be on the Day of the Dead. And in tender honor of the grief that we are all carrying, this is Joan Baez singing about La Llorona, or the crying woman. Let's listen with our hearts as well as our heads.
Todos me dicen el negro, Llorona, negro pero cariñoso. Todos me dicen el negro, pero cariñoso. Yo soy como el chile verde, Llorona, picante pero sabroso. Yo soy como el chile verde, Llorona, picante pero sabroso. Ay, de mi Llorona, más grande su pena. Ay, de mi llorona, llorona de azul celeste. Ay, de mi llorona, llorona de azul celeste. Y aunque la vida me cueste, llorona, no dejaré de quererte. Y aunque la vida me cueste, llorona, no dejaré de quererte.
That was La Llorona, sung by Joan Baez, a very traditional Mexican folk song in honor of the Mexican Day of the Dead, which occurs this year on Saturday, November the 1st. This is the Lifeboat Hour, and I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. My very special guest tonight is Barry Spector from the Bay Area of Northern California, and we're talking about the grief ritual that Barry and his partner Maya have been offering every year on or near the Day of the Dead. I believe it's been going on for about 17 years, and this year it happens to fall on the Day of the Dead, November 1st, and I want to continue this incredibly rich conversation with Barry regarding the grief ritual. And so, what's the actual purpose, Barry, of this grief ritual that you conduct every year? And how did you guys decide to offer it and become so committed to offering it every year?
Well, let me give you a little background just briefly about myself. I would say throughout much of my 30s and 40s, I would personally dread the approach of fall. I don't know if this was about seasonal affective disorder, but I would experience all kinds of minor accidents and minor illnesses. I would just dread the, but then gradually over time, I began to realize that it was my own darkness that I was unwilling to examine. I don't have time to, tell you much about that, but once I made that realization, I began to turn and face the darkness and the darkness of the year began to study. We learned about the Celtic view of the world, which is indigenous to Europe, that the year has two halves, the light half and the dark half, and the world switches from the light half to the dark half around November 1st, and then back to the light half around May 1st. And so the Europeans had these traditions, and when the Catholics took over, they after centuries of trying to suppress them, they gave up and eventually incorporated this time as All Souls Day and All Saints Day, right around November 1st and 2nd. And then when the Spanish conquered Mexico, they discovered that the Mexicans had their own indigenous traditions, and eventually incorporated them. From August, when the Mexicans had their tradition, into the Catholic calendar, and so Day of the Dead has been Dia de los Muertos has been one of the most important events in throughout Latin America for these 500 years. What we're trying to do is just as you've been saying about what you do and what Francis does, we're trying to give people the opportunity to lay down some of this burden. And we understand that it's a very difficult thing for people to conceive of to spend a whole day in grief with people, often people that they don't know. And again, that's part of the legacy that we suffer from as Americans. I mean, we don't really have community here. I mean, some of us have community in our churches or we have networks of interest of things that we share with people. but we rarely have moments of real community. And so we do the best that we can to create a safe container using all kinds of ritual processes that we've learned over the years to invite a community. It's usually between 30 and 40 people to turn up. One of the things that we encourage people to do is act as if they've been living together in a community their whole lives, because there's so much at stake, we don't want to. We don't have the luxury to waste time, and we have to plunge into this work, which is sacred and necessary. A large part of what we do is building and holding this container to allow people to sink down into the feelings and to feel close, at least, to the sense of safety that they need. And it's a curious thing about this kind of ritual. We call it radical ritual. The idea is, again, it's really just an indigenous way of looking at things. You build the container, you invite the spirits in, and then you get out of the way because you cannot predict what's going to happen. When we speak about safety, we're thinking on the one hand, we're talking about we're making it safe enough for people to experience and share the feelings. On the other hand, there's a sense in which we don't know what's going to happen. So there's a curious line there between too safe and not safe enough that we try to dance along.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I conduct the grief rituals and Francis does and you guys do. I usually try to do them over the course of a Friday night, an all-day Saturday, and a half a day on Sunday. And that's great if people have the time and the place for doing the ritual properly. But you guys do the ritual in one day. And I've been to one of your grief rituals, and I can tell our listeners that it's a very powerful, healing, and incredibly supportive experience. I really came away feeling deeply connected with the people there, and I had a precious taste for one day of loving community. And let me just say here, people on the West Coast, this is a fabulous opportunity to participate in an amazing, soul-altering, heart-healing experience that we just don't have access to in this culture. So please contact Barry and Maya and consider attending this very affordable one-day ritual. And if you would like to talk to Barry and Maya or myself about traveling to your community to do a weekend grief ritual, give us a shout. You can contact Barry at, would you give us the contact information, Barry?
Well, basically through the website, www.barryandmayaspector.com.
And, of course, you can contact me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net.
Now,
so, Barry, I'm
can
sorry, what
email?
Were you saying?
Can I give my email as well?
Absolutely.
That would be S as in Sam, H as in Harry, M as in Mary, O, Z as in Victor, E as in Edward, R as in Robert, @comcast.net. And you are welcome to email me questions about the Day of the Dead ritual.
Great. So, Barry, would you tell our listeners in general what happens at a grief ritual? Many people may not have any idea what a ritual is like, so please elaborate.
Well, we understand that grieving may never completely end, but our idea is we want to clarify our intentions to achieve closure with old wounds and with those loved ones who are no longer with us. It's about addressing unfinished business, in a sense. Those of us who are creating the space build two great shrines or altars. One is the shrine to the ancestors, and we try to make it as beautiful as possible. We try to incorporate flowers, especially marigolds, which are the traditional Mexican flowers for the Day of the Dead, and photos of the dead and sacred objects. And we encourage everybody who comes to the ritual to bring as much as they can to add, so that not only do people have their own individual sacred items on the altars, but they also have a sense of participating in the creation of the event itself. And we also have another altar, which is at the far end of this hall space that we're using, and we call that the altar to the other world. In a sense, they're similar altars, but the first one is in traditional red and orange colors that the Dagre use, and it's about fire. The ancestors are connected with fire and that cosmology. And the other altar is of blue and white typically because it's all about water, and we'll have great bowls of water there and stones and white and blue candles and that kind of thing. And it's all about creating that evocative space where people can come to lay down their burden. So that's what the room looks like. And we also have a lot of poems up on the walls and such that also get people in the mood. And the idea of everything that we're doing in the creation of the space, and especially in the whole first half of the day with poetry and songs and chanting and small group getting together, or sometimes we'll have dyads speaking to each other, is about evoking the emotions, just building up that sense of emotion in the space. And part of what we do is the naming of the dead. And since we count New Year is November 1st, essentially, then I'm in the habit for many years now of keeping track of those who have died in the previous 12 months, which would include celebrities but also political activists, and of course the individual dead connected that we know personally, and also the victims of the world. The Michael Moores of the world. Not Michael Moore, who am I thinking? I'm sorry.
Michael Brown.
Michael Moore is still with us.
Yeah,
the Michael
yeah.
Browns of the world. Because this is also connected to the grief that we're all carrying but not acknowledging. I mean, every time a young black man is shot down in some urban place in America, it affects all of us, even if we don't want to pay attention, even if we don't want to read anything about it. It's all impacting us. And so it's not just the loved ones that have died, it's those far away. It's the 465 children who were killed in the Gaza bombings this summer. And the hundreds of others who are permanently paralyzed. I mean, if we just stop for a few seconds and think about this, it should make us crazy with grief. It absolutely should. And again, the reason why so many of us don't want to come to these rituals is because we don't trust that it'll be safe. I'll tell you, one of the most common things I've ever heard at men's conferences is something like this. I know I have so much grief in me, but I can't let it out because I know that if I let it out, it'll never end. And that is a very common thing I've heard from people, especially men over the years, not just men, but especially men. And I have to acknowledge there's some truth. There is some truth in that. I mean, once we open ourselves to the process of grief, we don't know if it's going to end. We can't enter the process thinking we're going to do this for a while in hopes that we're going to come out the other end, because that is a way of not being present. To be present with grief is to be with grief and nothing else, although rage may also surface. But to be present with the strong emotions without any sense of time. And that's another thing that we're trying to do when we're creating this space. We're trying to make this a space that's outside of space and outside of time. I've used the word liminal. That's the word that the anthropologists use. But it's really to describe that space betwixt and between. It's between the worlds. And in fact, that's exactly, if we go back to this notion of the Celtic description of this time of the year, the old Celtic word was Samhain, to describe the Celtic New Year's. And this is something that indigenous people share in many places, that at certain times of the year, and for us it's going to be around November 1st, there's a space of 2 or 3 days when the veil between the worlds fades away and things get very unclear. And this is why they say the dead want to return. They want to return to be fed, and they want to be fed by our grief and our beauty. That's the thing that the Dogger and also the Mayans say, grief and beauty. And that's one reason why we try to make the space so beautiful. So anyway, so we've got this space. We're invoking the dead. We're doing poetry. Hopefully, I'll get a chance to do one or two poems for you, a characteristic poem that we do before this hour is over. And we find that people usually appreciate the opportunities to break up the large group and sit in smaller groups of 5 or 6. Some people feel are able to share in larger groups. Other people feel more safety in sitting with a smaller group of, that you can really just almost be touching each other. Other people can do it in dyads, like I said. And so we try to offer all of these different opportunities. But eventually, we're building up, ideally, we're just building up this feeling, the deep feelings in the room. And then the day will shift, and we bring everyone to one end of to the ancestor shrine part of the room, and we bring in the drummers, and we teach a chant, typically, from the Dogra tradition. And then we move, we try to help people move the grief into their bodies. We're asking everybody to stand during this period, and as the drummers begin, we encourage people to dance and share the chant for the entire time that we're doing it. And then we encourage people, when they are moved, to move from the village space where we're all sharing at one end of the room among the ancestors, to go across the space, this liminal space, and stand or sit or lie or whatever they need to do in front of the water shrine and speak to their dead and hopefully achieve the release, the big release that we're all trying to achieve. And we've discovered, we've learned that it's an astonishing thing that can happen, because when the space is set up like this in the traditional Dogra sense, where the village is at your back and they're all drumming and chanting, and it's very loud, and the ancestors are right in front of you in the water shrine, you can sometimes feel the pull from the water shrine in one direction, and you can definitely feel the push of the village behind you, encouraging you to just let it go, to just drop this huge weight that you've been carrying. And this is one of the things that people have told us many times over the years, that they've really felt it. And this whole process replicates the three-part process that some of you may know from Joseph Campbell, the Hero's Quest, and it's also in the initiation process. So that's three parts, where you begin, you leave the village, you spend time in the other world, and then, most importantly, the third part is you come back. And so when people come back, if they're finished with their grieving, the village encourages, welcomes them with great display and pomp and ceremony, and we welcome people coming back into the village as heroes and heroines who have done this difficult work of sacrificing so much of what they've been carrying. And one of the things we've noticed over the years is that if people come back and they're still weeping, we encourage them to go back to the water shrine and continue grieving, because again, it's as I said earlier, as the Dogra say, if a person is still grieving in the village, they're still carrying some of that toxicity back into the village. And so it's in the village's own interest to encourage the people to go back and continue their grieving.
I'd like to talk a little bit about feedback. And I'm going to ask you what kind of feedback you've gotten over the years from people who've attended your grief rituals. And I can tell you that every time I've facilitated grief ritual, I've witnessed unbelievable changes in people. People have told me that they've never experienced such deep support from a community of people that they hadn't known before. They've told me that as a result of that support, they lost their culturally programmed embarrassment about grieving in public, that they felt really washed clean inside and felt as if a huge burden had been lifted off of them. And here's the amazing part. People have told me, they always tell me, that contrary to their expectations and fears, they felt more joy and they ended up laughing more the next day. And there was an inexplicable lightness that they hadn't experienced for a long time. Is that some of the kind of feedback that you get, Barry?
Absolutely. You know, and that lightness is a perfect description, whether it's metaphor or physical reality, because it's the other side of the weight. I mean, we've been using this metaphor of weight, and again, sometimes it's not metaphor. I mean, you can see some people, the way they carry themselves. I mean, I'm not a body worker, but I can read body language to some extent, and I can see a person, what a person's like who needs to grieve or hasn't been grieving. I mean, it looks like they're carrying 80 pounds on their shoulders.
Right.
And so you're absolutely right. I mean, it's possible. We can't guarantee anything, but it's possible. And we've certainly seen countless examples of people who feel light. And again, I would refer back to that quote from Maladoma, people who can't grieve that don't know how to laugh. My personal experience and the experience in the feedback that we've got from many, many people is once I began to open up to the dark emotions of grief and also anger, which can come up in these rituals, because goddess knows we carry a lot of rage about these diminished lives that we've been forced to live in this modern world. Once we're able to let go, to open up, to express, or at least to feel, the difficult emotions on one end, the astonishing irony is that we then become open to feeling the positive emotions to a much greater extent than we ever thought we could. And so people laugh, and people have energy, and people, again, I mean, back to the question of political activism. People have told us they've had more energy available to do the kind of work in the world that they need to do. And that goes back to what you said. If you're only feeling the fire, you're going to burn out. And I would add, if you're only feeling the water, you're likely to drown. But opening to one allows you more access to the other. So, and that's a large part of the feedback we've got from people over the years. But I would also say, if people come thinking that they're going to grieve once and be finished, I have to say, the world was not constructed like that. We are all carrying infinite loads of grief, every one of us. Regardless of whether we've lost anybody dear to ourselves personally recently, the first time I went to a major grief ritual, I discovered that all kinds of people that I had not thought of in years, people that I hadn't even cared that much about, all of whom were dead, came to me in this ritual, and they basically told me, poetically speaking, they told me, okay, I'm here now. You've got to grieve for me now too. And these were people I hadn't even cared that much about consciously. And this thing for me, fortunately, went on for hours. Every time one of these mm-hmm. people came to my consciousness, I found myself grieving for them as well.
Right. So, well, you know, that. I, in a moment, I really want to hear some of your poetry. We're going to make time for that. But I just wanted to say something that kind of bounces back to something you said earlier. And it's very relevant here. You know, many, many people, men and women, have this feeling that if I start grieving, you know, if I open the floodgates, they'll never stop, as you mentioned before. And I get this all the time when, as I work with people in life coaching. And, you know, they say, if I pop the cork, it'll never stop. And so what I say to that is, well, because people are very afraid of going into depression. And I like to quote Francis on that, you know, Francis Weller, because one of the things he says is that grief is many, many, or depression is many, many times unmetabolized grief. So the more we allow ourselves to grieve, I should say, the less likely we are to, you know, find it frozen in our bodies as clinical depression. The other thing is that, yes, the grief will go on, but it will either go on by over flooding us in some way, overwhelming us in some way, and maybe becoming depression, or maybe becoming physical symptoms, or we will consciously continue with it from time to time and get the support that we need. And the support that we need is what is key here, because nobody should be doing this by themselves. Don't you agree, Barry?
Absolutely, yeah. And I would use myself as a good example. I think I was depressed for many years before I began to acknowledge the grief I was carrying and begin to open to it. I feel grief a lot. And I don't feel like I get it, even myself, even leading grief rituals a couple of times a year, I don't feel like I get enough of it. But the other side of it is, like I said a few minutes ago, I laugh a lot more than I used to. You know, I can appreciate beauty in the world that I couldn't appreciate. My emotional gates are relative to the way I was 20 years ago are wide open, and that's part of what it really means to be an adult and a mature or shall I say with great reservations an initiated person in the world is to be acquainted with grief enough so that you can also be acquainted with ecstasy. And if you can't have the one, you definitely won't have the other. I mean, you may have some New Age caricature of ecstasy that you think you may have, but it's not the real thing.
Right. Well, another aspect of grief and grief rituals is the power of poetry, as you mentioned, and the power of poetry to evoke grief. So I'd like to hear you share a little bit more in this way, Barry. Would you say more about the connection between grief and poetry? And then would you offer at least one poem that you feel really communicates this?
Well, poetry, like mythology, is the language of the soul. It bypasses the conscious mind to some extent, and the conscious or the unconscious gates that prevent us from accessing our soul, the needs of the soul. So we have found that telling poetry, especially at the beginnings of these events, is always a way to help evoke things. And this is one poem I tell most years at the beginning of the day. It's called All Souls by May Sarton. It goes like this. Did someone say, oh, by the way, let me say this. When we tell our poems at our rituals, we are part of what we call the oral tradition. We find that that when we recite the poems rather than reading them, it comes, in some mysterious way, it comes right out of our bodies, not out of our heads, and it goes directly into other people's bodies, you might say. So So I didn't mention this earlier. Part of our tradition is always, when we're doing the poetry, is to be reciting it rather than reading it. So this is All Souls by Mae Sarton. She says, "Did someone say that there would be an end? An end. Oh, an end to love and mourning? Such voices speak when sleep and waking blend, the cold, bleak voices of the early morning, when all the birds are dumb in dark November. Remember and forget, forget, remember. After the false night, warm, true voices wake, voice of the dead that touches the cold living. Through the pale sunlight, once more gravely speak, tell me again while the last leaves are falling. Dear child, what has been once so interwoven cannot be raveled, nor the gift ungiven. Now the dead move through us all, still glowing. Mother and child, lover and lover mated, are wound and bound together and in flowing. What has been plaited cannot be unplaited. Only the strands grow richer with each loss, and memory makes kings and queens of us. Dark into light, light into darkness spin. When all the birds have flown to some real haven, we who find shelter in the warmth within, listen and feel new cherished, new forgiven. As the lost human voices speak through us and blend our complex love, our mourning, without end."
Mm. So thank you for that. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Do you have another one that you'd like to share?
Yeah, let's go. There's a wonderful prayer from the Kuba people of Zaire. "There is no needle without piercing point. There is no razor without trenchant blade. Death comes in many forms. With our feet, we walk the goat's earth. With our hands, we touch God's sky. Some future day in the heat of noon, I shall be carried shoulder high through the village of the dead. When I die, don't bury me under forest trees. I fear their thorns. When I die, don't bury me under forest trees. I fear their dripping water. Bury me under the great shade trees of the market. I want to hear the drums beating. I want to feel the dancers' feet."
Thank you for that. You know, one of the most beautiful things that I experience in the grief rituals, when I've been a participant and when I've led them, is the way people so deeply connect, the way they come together as complete strangers to bond in this sacred experience that everybody is having in the grief ritual. And, you know, I've discovered, you know, people have told me stories of, you know, "I met so-and-so 10 years ago in the grief ritual and we're still in touch," you know, or maybe I see that person regularly. And so there's a wonderful sense of community. And I just like to share this little short poem that I know you're familiar with from Rafael Jesus Gonzalez. And it's about bridging this distance between us through sacred ritual. And Gonzalez writes, "The distance between us is holy ground, to be traversed, feet bare, arms raised in joyous dance so that it is crossed, and the tracks of our pilgrimage shine in the darkness to light our coming together in a bright and steady light."
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I thought it would be. So, again, what is the cost of the one-day grief ritual, and how do people register?
It's $50 at the door, and it'll include a little bit of refreshments. But $30 in advance. although we do stress that no one will be turned away for lack of funds. In fact, we absolutely encourage and hope that people will come forward and offer to volunteer on work scholarships. So money is not the question. I mean, we want to just pay our expenses, but basically we need help. And the help comes in many ways. I mean, it helped with people helping to work and set up and clean up. It also comes in terms of people's participation and being fully involved in the ritual. That is, you know, we often tell people, even if you're not feeling the grief right now, your attention to holding the container is helping people immensely. And again, it's about community, because people have different roles at different times in the community. Some people are drumming, some people are grieving, some people are chanting and just watching out and helping the others. So everybody's helping in some way, although work scholarships are one of the best ways. We encourage them because we don't need the money. We need the help more than the money. But people can pay ahead. They can get our address on the website. They can mail me a check, or they can pay on PayPal using that email I gave a little while ago.
So would you give the website address again, Barry, so people have that in general? Because through the website, they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, thanks. www.barryandmayaspector.com, SPECTOR.
You know, as you were talking, we've got just a couple of minutes left, but, you know, I just wanted to mention that, you know, you alluded at one point to Michael Brown, who was the young black man who was killed in August in Ferguson, Missouri. And, you know, we've talked about this before, and some of our friends like Michael Mead and, of course, Maladoma have talked about this in terms of what would happen if we conducted, in places of tragedy like this, conducted grief rituals. I heard Michael Brown's father say on the news a couple of days ago, "I will never get over this. I will be grieving for the rest of my life." And, you know, when this kind of thing happens, my heart just goes out to these folks. And I just want to, you know, take a grief ritual to that kind of community immediately so that people have a chance to mourn together and support each other in that way.
Yeah. Well, people in the inner city, African Americans and Latinos, they know this. They know when somebody's killed in Oakland, there's always a shrine that goes up on a fence at the very place where it happened. People know in their indigenous bones. They know that the importance of all this. But I would also like to throw in an imaginative thought.
We have just 2 minutes left.
Okay, this culture needs this so much, and it needs, and we all need it, and the culture needs it, and we need it locally where the grief happens. But I'm trying to imagine ways in which the culture shifts so that we can do this as a nation. I mean, I would like to imagine a time when in the largest sports stadium in the nation, a sitting American president gets down on his knees before an African American descendant of a slave and a Native American and begs forgiveness for the entire nation. And everyone in that stadium and everyone watching it, you know, electronically, are all grieving together what we have done as a nation.
Well, I wish desires that someday we would see that.
Yeah, can you imagine the healing that could happen?
Oh, it would be phenomenal. It would be phenomenal. So, everyone, please, on the West Coast, in the Bay Area, contact Barry at www.barryandmayaspector.com to learn more about the grief ritual or to have Barry and Maya come to your community to do one. And Thank you so much for listening, for joining us. Carry these words in your heart, and may they motivate you and direct you to create a grief ritual in your community or to attend the one that Barry and Maya are offering on November 1st in the Bay Area. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you, Barry, for being with us.
Great to talk to you, Carolyn.
Bye-bye.
Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich, that's how it goes. Everybody knows.